it's not just political The Hague. It's
yeah.
also the islands themselves.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you look yeah. at the discussions on Bonaire about the master plan Bonaire, half the people say we need to change. We need to do it differently.
Yeah.
So there is a movement ongoing that I think has huge potential to change the way things work and actually put the nature at the center of your economy.
Absolutely.
It just requires yeah. action, you know?
Yeah. Welcome to another episode of We're Not Doomed. Today we'll be talking with Arjan de Groene, a program manager at the WWF who focuses on the Caribbean Netherlands. With Arjan, we cover a whole range of topics. We talk about his work and approach when it comes to protecting the environment, and the somewhat debated role of NGOs when it comes to doing this. We also talk about the challenges he encounters with protecting the environment of the Caribbean and discuss whether these challenges are really so much different compared to other countries or islands. Both Tim and I have worked with Arjan previously, and we are very happy he wanted to join us on our podcast. We hope you enjoy our conversation, so let's get right into it.
Hi, I'm Tim.
And I'm Stacey.
And welcome to We're Not Doomed,
a podcast all about the human nature crisis that we're facing and what we can do about it in the Caribbean.
Hi, Arjan.
Hello.
Hi, Arjan.
Could you tell us more about yourself?
Yes, very happy to. Okay, well, I'm Arjan de Groene. I coordinate the Caribbean Netherlands program for WWF in the Netherlands. And I'm a marine biologist. And yeah, I'm trying to basically save the marine environment on the Dutch islands. I actually went into this direction of nature conservation because of something that happened a long time ago when mm-hmm. we were six or eight. I don't even remember. I was a little boy and we went to Mauritius.
Who's and, we? Your family and you?
Yeah, with the family.
Mm-hmm.
And I have no memories whatsoever before I was 10. So the only thing I remember is that I was on this boat with a glass bottom boat and I was amazed by all the life underwater there.
Mm-hmm.
And that stuck with me. So I kind of followed that path of trying to preserve that, yeah, the coral reefs around the world. So then I went studying in Nijmegen. After my study, during my studies, I did an internship in Tanzania, on mm-hmm. Zanzibar, looking into the way fish migrate from their nursery habitats out to the reef. So from the mangroves through the seagrass to the reefs. Then I actually worked in pharmaceuticals for a little bit.
That's a career switch.
Yeah, that was a career switch. So I decided to leave that area as soon as I was able to. And then I moved to Seychelles, where I ran a nature NGO, basically trying to link up the private sector with nature conservation. So Seychelles has a lot of small islands, and some of these islands are privately owned by either Seychellois owners or foreign owners. And they try to differentiate themselves as resorts for high-end tourism by having unique nature. Mm-hmm. So the hotel owners don't know anything about nature. So they need help with basically turning an island that used to be a coconut plantation and everything has been demolished into a biodiversity hotspot where endangered birds get translocated to, where all the invasive species get removed from. And that's basically what I did there.
Nice.
And we worked a lot on fisheries as well with the local fishermen. We tried to basically get them on board with a monitoring program to get an idea of how the fish stocks were doing and if there was anything that the fishermen wanted to change in the way they fish, and basically taking them along the road towards sustainability by explaining the biology, and they would be explaining what they run into as fishermen, what mm-hmm. their problems were, trying to match these things and try and come up with, okay, this is a protected species. Were you aware of that? And then if the answer was no, then you basically say explain why and So, and basically work together on, okay, what can we do to make sure that you can still catch this fish in 20 years?
Right.
That worked quite well. That project's actually still ongoing. And then I moved back to the Netherlands because there was this opportunity at WWF to coordinate the Caribbean Netherlands program. So I've been doing that ever since, really, since 2016.
Nice. Before we go into the WWF program, could you tell us a bit why you ended up on Seychelles? Because that doesn't seem like a very common place for Dutch biologists to set up their own NGOs.
No, I was one of 24 Dutch people on the in the Seychelles.
Whoa.
They kept a record. no, basically, a friend of mine was living on Aldabra, which is one of the southern islands in Seychelles. Yeah. It's a World Heritage Site. It's, I don't know, many, many kilometers across, and it is completely uninhabited. And it's miles, hundreds of miles away from the nearest other inhabited place. So I was basically asked to do a reef mapping exercise. So we wanted to know, okay, we need to protect the area around this island, but what is there? What does it look like? How many, where are the fish? How many, where's the coral? How deep does it go? What measures should we take in the protection of that reef based on what is where? So that was quite an amazing time, I have to say. Being on an uninhabited island with just 15 researchers and diving everywhere. And it was amazing. I've never seen so many sharks.
You possibly might have met one of our former speakers, Adam Mitchell. He used to live on Aldabra as a researcher as well.
Yeah. That was before my time. Yes. I've heard his name. I don't actually know him, but it's a small world.
It really is, apparently.
Yeah.
And I was just about to say that you probably share this with Tim, is that, you know, often when terrible things happen in the environment, Tim tends to say, well, you know, screw humans, just give me all the animals in the world and I'm a happy man. I'd rather deal
with it. I say that?
Yeah, you do.
Yeah, that's true.
And I think you've made similar remarks before as well, Arjan.
Yeah. an inhabited island with
exactly.
pristine nature.
Yeah, wonderful.
It's heaven on earth.
It is. Cool. But then you went to the Netherlands because you saw this opportunity or this vacancy at a WWF for program coordinator.
Yeah, my wife needed to go back to the Netherlands to start her education anyway. So we were looking for something interesting. And I saw this opportunity and I thought, that's it. That's what I need to be doing.
Cool.
So I applied and it was an instant match, I think.
Nice.
So that's how I came here.
Yeah. And so you set up your own NGO in Seychelles and now you're working at a very large NGO in the Netherlands. And it's a very well-known NGO globally. How do you see the role of NGOs when it comes to protecting the environment? You know, why do we need NGOs to take on this responsibility?
That's a good question. There's actually different reasons for that. Just to give an example, I referred to it a couple of minutes ago already, but in Seychelles, for instance, the hotel owners that want a biodiverse island don't even know what biodiverse means. So they need help, basically someone with the expertise and the willingness and capacity to advise and do the work. So that's one reason. Another reason is that nature itself doesn't have a voice. So somebody needs to basically explain or advocate for nature because nobody else is going to do it. And it's a good way to actually gather all the expertise on a certain topic in a system where you can independently, without any strings attached, look at what is needed for nature without taking into account all the I need to make a profit or I need to get voters or all that stuff is irrelevant.
So you independently from politics and business, so to say.
Yeah. Although you obviously have to work with the private sector, with communities, with the governments to get things done, but you can be that independent voice.
Yeah. Now, one of the reasons I'm asking this as well, this is a question that I've been thinking about a lot myself lately, is that even though I applaud and I'm very happy that there are NGOs that are giving nature this voice, sometimes you also see that there's this tendency for people in the community to ascribe the responsibility of protecting the environment to NGOs and no longer to themselves. And you also see this within governments, for example, saying, well, you know, you have the NGOs or you have those, you know, those platforms or those organizations taking care of it. It's not something that we need to be very mindful of. So do you think that is a legitimate risk or like a pitfall of having NGOs?
Yes, on several levels, actually, because I am pretty sure that there are people that, how do you say, pay off their sustainability debt by donating, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. I give so much per year to a nature organization, therefore I don't have to do anything myself.
Yeah.
So that's one level, which is actually why, for instance, WWF is more and more leaning towards engaging the people that support the organization. So not only the donating to the organization, but also engaging them in the work itself. Organize think tanks with the people that support us. Those kinds of things. Volunteer schemes, things like that.
Yeah, so it's no longer like this group of people in an organization taking care of things, but a community gets a seat at the table as well.
Yeah, it's difficult because you obviously don't always reach everyone you want to reach, but that's the idea, yeah.
Yeah.
So that's one aspect. Sometimes NGOs willingly take on responsibilities that should actually be with other organizations, or they get the responsibility mandated to the NGO from a government, for instance.
Right.
And that's where the difficulty lies, because obviously if you see an NGO doing the work, you expect that NGO is responsible for it. And then you automatically turn to that NGO if something goes wrong, if you want something. So yes, that's a real risk. It happens. Mm-hmm. And I think as an NGO, you need to be really, really aware of that and make it clear that whoever is responsible voices that responsibility. So if, just to name an example, STINAPA, the marine park management or the park management organization on Bonaire.
Yeah.
They manage the parks, but they get that mandate from the local government.
Mm-hmm.
And you see that many people on the island turn to STINAPA automatically if they disagree with the rules that were made, if they feel that something should be done, where they actually should turn to the local government. And that's something that you're right, you need to be aware of.
I think that's it's nice to hear that you also say that there are different layers in the way that kind of that risk exists, or different ways in the risks. Yeah, and I hope that people will become a bit more aware of it. And so you mentioned some things that WWF is doing to create that awareness or to kind of reverse that idea that people might have about NGOs. Do they also do this on the Caribbean?
Well, it's not an active standalone process.
Yeah.
It's basically just the way you run projects or set up projects or bring people together. To give an example, there's this nature and environment policy plan that was written by the Ministry of Agriculture, Nature and Food Quality and the Ministry of Infrastructure and the Ministry of Internal Affairs. But it's their policy document. But what WWF did do is we organized stakeholder consultation. We brought all the people together to discuss what should be in that plan.
Mm-hmm.
Even though we are not responsible for the plan, we find it important that all that kind of information and the stakeholder consultation is done properly.
Yeah.
But during those stakeholder consultations, we do state that it's not our responsibility, and we include the ministry in those stakeholder consultations. So, you know, it's also a matter of, just being aware of the risk that you're going to be seen as the responsible party, and make sure that the actual responsible party is on board.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's always kind of a thing you need to consider. But like you said, it almost feels as if it's like damned if you do, damned if you don't, because if you don't do anything, the chances are very high that these stakeholders won't be involved or the process is not, you know, guided properly. And if you do, then people see you as kind of the owner of the or the responsible party for that process. And that's also not something like you want to, like an impression you want to create, right? So, yeah, I guess that's a challenge as well.
No, but what is actually quite, well, it's a good thing and a bad thing, but it does result in people turning to you if they need guidance or right. have questions, yeah. which is fine.
Yeah.
Because that gives me, that gives us more touch with the community. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm trying to say?
Yeah,
so absolutely. If people turn yeah. to us with yeah. questions, then we are aware and we can actually help if, yeah. if it's within our
yeah.
work fields. Or if they ask questions that should be directed at the responsible mm-hmm. party, then obviously we direct them there.
Yeah. So it almost right. seems as if you're kind of reshaping the way that NGOs are kind of fitting in their role or taking their responsibility when it comes to protecting the environment. Would that be a accurate conclusion?
Well, I try to do it for WWF on the island.
Yeah.
I can't presume to be doing that for other organizations.
yeah, okay.
But yeah, in an ideal world, you would have very good and clear responsibilities that everybody is aware of.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, government makes the rules. The park authority enforces those rules or manages the park because the government tells them to.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
So that should be known, but that doesn't mean that you cannot work together on joint projects, even though you might not be the actually responsible party.
Yeah.
Yeah. And with regards to these joint projects, like how or do or should large or small NGOs like complement each other with regards to these projects? Because I can imagine like a WWF as a very large partner, they might come across very dominant, even though most of the work might be for, say, a STINAPA. How's this? How do you see this?
That is for WWF. That is a problem in the sense that, well, problem. It's
a challenge.
Well, yes and no. It is a perception until you actually work with people.
Right.
Right.
But you're right in the sense that if you want to collaborate with smaller NGOs or smaller entities, there is a risk of them basically looking at WWF and being afraid that as a large NGO, oh, we're going to tell them what to do mm-hmm. or we're going to take over mm-hmm. or whatever. So the last couple of years that I've been working for WWF, that is exactly what I've been trying to avoid. And
how do you do that?
Well,
basically, I do not initiate any project without the consent of our partners or the community if necessary. I mean, it kind of depends.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
But I'll never initiate something and then tell people, hey, this is how we're going to do it.
Right.
Because that doesn't work.
Well, maybe you could tell a bit about, you know, the role of WWF on the Caribbean. Because prior to the constitutional reforms, WWF wasn't as prominently present, at least not in the Dutch Caribbean. But it changed with the constitutional reforms and the Caribbean Netherlands becoming part of the Netherlands. So maybe you could tell a bit about that. So what is the role of the WWF on the Caribbean Netherlands since the constitutional reforms?
There's been a decision made within WWF that, and this was a while ago already, mm-hmm. but basically we used to fund, you know, tigers in Asia and mm-hmm. the gorillas in the Congo and all these big overseas projects. And at some point, we and this is all before my time, so yeah. I can't presume to speak for whoever was taking those decisions back then. But they wanted to put more emphasis on our own backyard. And that's when they decided to start a North Sea program, the Caribbean Netherlands program, yeah. Lifted to a higher level, because we've always been in the Dutch Caribbean ever yeah. since the 60s already, but it was always remote. So we would be funding projects, we would be responding to requests from the region,
mm-hmm.
and now we are way more hands-on. So now we've decided, well, we're actually getting more and more hands-on, which started 5 years ago, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And that has changed our role quite a bit. So I'm on the islands way more than the people that ran this program before me. We have two local consultants that implement the project for parts of our project. And we work much closer together with our partner organizations than we used to. It's not just handing out funding, but it's also working together to strengthen organizations, to save that mm-hmm. coral reef, to push for sustainable fisheries with the fishermen, you know?
Yeah.
And that's yeah. changed a lot. And I want, personally, this is not necessarily a WWF mm-hmm. Opinion, but personally, I think we should move even further into that direction yeah. and actually have a presence there always.
Because like an office, a local office or something.
For instance, yeah. But if you're not on the islands, you're not in touch enough with what's happening within yeah. the community mm-hmm. yeah. to be able to adequately respond to that. For instance, now there's this Corona crisis.
Mm-hmm.
What you see happening is that people are reconsidering the way they run the island.
Yeah.
There used to be a lot of cruise yeah. tourism. There used to be, which had a big impact on nature, but also on the people, because you couldn't even get into Kalendijk, the main city on the island anymore when there was a cruise ship. But you see that people are starting to think, how can we do this differently? How can we restart tourism without reverting back to that state that we used to be in?
Yeah.
And then my hands itch, you know. I'm sitting here in the Netherlands and I'm thinking, but we can help. We can organize brainstorm sessions. We can investigate what business yeah. cases should fit with that, you know, all those kinds of things. And then I'm here, you know. Yeah. So
that's yeah. frustrating.
That's frustrating. Yeah.
Yes, quite.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I feel you. I mean, even today you see all Same. Those, you know, meetings pass by online, and that they had this, you know, presentation of the new strategic plan, or, you know, this think tank session or something like that. I'm like, oh, I wish I could have been there. Not that I don't trust the people that are present, but more that there's so much opportunity and that you just hope that all items will be considered. And I agree with you that I think, you know, the WF is an important player in that, especially because of the growing involvement of the organization when it comes to the environment of the Caribbean Netherlands.
Yeah, and there's definitely some, you know, on the islands you have the local government, you have the Marine Park Authority. On Bonaire you have a couple of really, really good nature organizations that focus on particular areas.
Mm-hmm.
But the park authorities are basically limited in the scope of their work to the parks, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The Sea Turtle Conservation Bonaire or ECHO, they do awesome work, but it's and that's changing, actually. I should reconsider, but ECHO used to be focused on the loras, mm-hmm. you know, and the Sea Turtle Conservation would be focused on sea turtles. But there's no entity there, no independent entity that looks at the whole island.
Yeah.
The whole picture of right. well, the public entity, of course, the local government. But they don't have the capacity to actually
consider all the elements.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
you know, that's something where I see that WWF could play a role and is trying to play a role.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think what you were
saying, filling in the gaps.
Yeah, and also I think what you were saying was that those, you know, individual or separate NGOs, so to say, they are trying to make those connections and to look at the environment and also the species they were initially trying to protect more holistically. So, you know, consider their habitats and consider the people and, you know, consider all these different elements as well. But at the same time, these organizations are very small and the work that they are doing is a lot. And, you know, there's always so much you can expect from, you know, a handful of people to take on, I guess.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And that's another issue specific to small islands, really. Mm-hmm. And that is that you only have so many people that can do the work.
Yeah.
If there's something that we as an organization can do to help wherever it's needed and contributes to the preservation of nature, then obviously we're going to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what are the, so we talked about them a little bit right now, but what are, according to you or for you, maybe the biggest challenges when it comes to protecting the environment in the Caribbean? So we talked about, you know, the limited capacity, but are these challenges really so unique or different from other places in the world? I mean, Seychelles, they are very small islands as well. Yeah. Could you tell a bit about that?
Yes and no. I mean, you have exactly the same problems that you have on every single small island, which is lack of people.
Mm-hmm.
On one hand, for nature, that's a good thing, because the pressures on nature are less. But at the same time, you can't expect to have five well-qualified marine biologists in a population of that on Sint-Eustatius, for instance, of 3,500 people.
Yeah.
So you're never going to be able to get all the expertise and the capacity you need to do projects that for nature need to be done. So that and that's the same everywhere. It was the same in Seychelles. So they what they actually did in Seychelles, and that's quite interesting, I found, is that they founded a university for environmental management. Mm-hmm. Was one of the studies they added there. And that was 10 years ago now, I think. But when I was there, the first graduates came out.
Nice.
And that was, it was a blessing. You could get qualified people on the island without having to fly them in from the UK or the Netherlands or wherever. So that worked really well.
Yeah. Yeah, because
I don't know if Bonaire is big enough for a university, but
Oh, why not? But that was also something I was about to say. It's not as if the people aren't there, but it's more, you know, you could either say there might be a lack of interest, which I don't know is necessarily the case, but I think more so a lack of having the appropriate, you know, knowledge or skills to engage in certain behaviors, you know, to engage in those conservation behaviors. And I think some people are super motivated to just learn as they go, but it helps so much if you can actually stimulate that knowledge and that skill development on island. So yeah, that will be an incredible development for all the islands. And even, you know, even if the universities of Aruba or Curaçao would, you know, have those programs, and then people from the other islands don't have to go all the way to the Netherlands or the States or, you know, places where they go now to get that education.
I agree. And I think it's happening.
Mm-hmm.
I know that they the University of Aruba started this system project program with quite a number of PhDs that can be trained locally for all kinds of different subjects. And when they finish, it's going to be like gold for the islands.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, no, I agree.
Yeah.
And I think it would be good if something like a traineeship or a learn on the job system for biologists or not biologists wanting to be involved in nature conservation would exist for the islands as well.
Yeah.
Well, it's something that I think DCNA, the Dutch Caribbean Nature Alliance, from one of your previous speakers,
mm-hmm.
Tazio,
yeah.
is actually looking into to see if that can be set up.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, and one of the challenges he mentioned as well, as you're referring to him, is that there's always also a lack of funding, money. Who's going to pay? Is this also so much different on the Dutch Caribbean or the Caribbean Netherlands compared to other places, you think?
I think it depends on where you, what you compare it to.
Mm-hmm.
If I look back at Seychelles, one of the great benefits for Seychelles was they were a developing country, an independent state, and they found nature important.
Right.
So big funders like the Global Environment Facility and the TNC and those big organizations, the UNDP, they all had programs there.
Yeah.
So the UNDP had an office with 30 people just distributing funds, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So a big part of their economy is supported by nature and nature management and nature protection, because millions and millions of dollars flow into that country from these big funders every year. Now, if you compare that with the Caribbean islands, there's again a split, because the three islands that are not part of the country, the Netherlands, so Curaçao, Aruba, and Sint Maarten, they sometimes fall under the Netherlands, and then they get excluded for all kinds of development funds.
Yeah.
And sometimes they are excluded from the Netherlands, and they don't get the funding from the Netherlands either, right? So they're in a difficult position. And if you compare that again with the Caribbean Netherlands, Bonaire, Ceiba, and Sint-Eustatius, they should get all their nature management funding from the Dutch government, because mm-hmm. they're part, well, not everything, of course. I mean, there needs to be some locally generated funding.
Yeah.
But for the big projects or for the structural support, they should be getting it from the Dutch government because it's part of the Netherlands.
Yeah.
But at the same time, the organizations that are on those three islands are not eligible for all these external funds like the GEF, for instance,
mm-hmm.
apart from the development fund. But so, yeah, it's difficult.
And yeah.
lack of money is only part of the problem. I mean, the ability to actually spend it on implementing projects needs to be there. And that kind of loops back to what we were talking about just now. If you don't have the expertise on the island to implement projects, then, yeah, you can send the money. But then who is going to implement
the project? And I guess the case is right now that if you were to do a project, you would have to hire very expensive, you know, external people to execute it, which is already way over the budget that is limited, right?
Yeah. And it's also difficult if you're on one of the islands to actually have this, have access to these people, these experts all across the world, because you're on a small island, and with the digital age, and especially now with all the Zooming, it's changing rapidly.
Mm-hmm.
But to actually find someone that has the specific expertise you're looking for can be a challenge.
But Arjen, if you have like a faculty or some learning program for some of these students to, for example, become marine biologists, how would you prevent them from leaving and going elsewhere where they could probably or maybe earn more? Wouldn't that be a big problem? Or suspect it could be a problem?
That is a big problem. I think many of the islands, the young people leave and they get an education, and some of them come back, but most don't. And it's logical. I mean, you have a lot of jobs in the United States, in the Netherlands, that are well paid and give you a lot of challenge. Whereas on the islands, the job market is pretty limited as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, even though they need the expertise, there's not many jobs for full-time marine biologists, for instance. So, you know, it's not illogical that it happens. It is a waste, though.
Yeah.
But because a lot of expertise could help their own island, basically. Yeah.
But how would they do it on the Seychelles then? Because there you said they did have the university and, you know, there's a lot of funding. But so all the marine biologists would just have very amazing jobs there. Everybody has something to do, even though the islands are small.
No, they actually had quite an interesting system. You were not allowed to stay away, because then they would send you, or the government would pay for your education abroad, but then you have to sign a contract that you have to come back and work for your own country for a couple of years, three years, I think. And the student debt is so high that it's only if you get a really, really, really good job, you could afford to stay away.
Yeah.
So many people had to come back, and some of them actually stay. So it works in a way. But I think the biggest step forward in Seychelles was the university.
Yeah. But then the students stayed, but then the government also made sure that there were jobs for them.
Yeah, that was the benefit of having these huge funds.
Right.
Because there were 30 people sitting in an office distributing funds.
Yeah.
You know, so jobs enough.
Okay. No, because that's something you hear, for example, on Curaçao as well a lot, right? So there's always this discussion about, oh, but there's this brain drain and blah, 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 which I have my thoughts about as well. I think, yeah, sure, a lot of people with higher educations leave. Not many people are very willing to go back. I think there is a changing trend there as well, because I think more and more people are feeling are taking on the responsibility to contribute back to the island, also observing the state of the islands right now. Things aren't going very well, and it's easier to scream and shout and stay away and rather to do something. But what you often heard from students, if you would ask them, or, you know, recently graduated students, like, yeah, I would like to go back, but there's no job for me there, or there's no way where I can execute my profession, the thing that I studied for all of these years, and there are so many opportunities elsewhere. So I think it's a combination of issues that need to be tackled, not only having this, you know, system where the government pays back the student debt loans, but also make sure that the jobs are there. And then it comes back to funding, I guess.
Yeah, or choices.
Yeah.
I mean, another way of looking at it is one of the things that you see in some countries is that they have a tax system, which it's a kind of a corporate social responsibility tax. They would have to pay 0.5% of their total revenue, so not profit, but revenue.
Yeah.
Every company in the country, and then half of that funding goes straight to government, and the other half you can choose, but you can choose only to give it to a social or nature conservation organization, or so you could give it to your soccer team, but you can also give it to a nature NGO.
Mm-hmm.
And that leverages so many different benefits, because not only do you leverage the funding to hire people and to run projects and for NGOs to exist, but at the same time, every company needs to think about what do I want to spend my tax on. So they are forced to think about what do I find important.
Yeah.
And that's when they turn to nature or to all kinds of other social options.
Mm-hmm.
But you get a way more engaged private sector if you have a system like that. So I'm a big advocate of that option.
Yeah. Why is the system not in place?
That sounds very interesting. Yeah.
I don't know. I'm thinking it has something to do with the fact that people or companies don't want to pay more tax.
Yeah.
No.
Well, it really fits something I think we will go more in depth on in a different episode, but that's, you know, just rethinking economic structures entirely. So maybe you've heard about the donut economy model from Kate Wayward. I think, you know, something like this would really fit in a model like that, you know, kind of to see how are funds being redistributed within communities, cities, islands, countries. So I'm hopeful that this will catch on and people will start doing this.
Yeah, it's a choice. And I think many governments don't really have these kinds of things on the radar.
No.
It's not on the priority list to sort out. And I get that, but it has such a big social impact, and you really help the people who want to do something from the goodness of their heart, so to speak, to do that.
Yeah.
You know? So, yeah. I'm a fan.
Me too.
Me too. Me three, I mean. So, Arjan, one of the core focuses of WWF in the Caribbean, I believe, is coral reefs, right? And are there any other topics, maybe even related to this, that you guys focus on?
I work for the Oceans Unit within WWF, and that means my focus is on the seas around the islands, with a heavy emphasis on the coral reefs because of their unique biodiversity, which is unique in not only the Netherlands, having coral reefs here, but also in the region. So that's what we try to focus on. But if you talk about protecting coral reefs, you're basically talking about everything you do on land as well. It's not only fisheries, it's not only tourism, it's not only pollution that has an effect on the reefs, but it's what causes these things. So for coral reefs, the one of the biggest issues is dirty water.
Mm-hmm.
So on the islands, for instance, on Saba and Statia, there's no sewage system, no wastewater cleaning whatsoever. So what happens there is that every time you flush the toilet, it goes into the ocean at some point, either directly via sewage canals.
Yeah, and drains.
Sewage drains or through the soil.
Mm-hmm.
And it slowly gets
but
into
also,
the ocean.
I mean, I remember that I was on a flight from Curacao to Bonaire last year, and I knew this was happening, but it was just it's mind-blowing to see. So I was in the, you know, the tiny, tiny airplane where, like, what is it, 8-10 people fit in, and I was looking outside a window, and we were flying over Curacao, and there was this big tanker filled with wastewater, sewage wastewater, dumping its contents into the ocean. That was on Curaçao. Right. That was not on Bonaire. But and they were doing it, like the argument there is that they do have legal permissions to do it because they don't have sufficient facilities to process the sewage properly. So there are certain locations where they are allowed between, what is it, Aanhalingstekens, bunny ears. How do you call those? quotation marks?
Quotation marks.
That they are allowed to do that because it's not, you know, directly on a coral reef and it's on a different part, you know, different part of the coast. But still, the impact will be there, right? If you just keep dumping all this sewage water in the ocean. And what happens on Curaçao might as well also affect other islands in the region, right?
Yeah, no, I think you're exactly right. And officially, I think vessels discharging wastewater need to do it a certain distance from the coast. But
yeah,
I'm pretty sure not everybody sticks to that rule. Actually, I was one of the first times I was on Bonaire. I was swimming in front of Kralendijk, the city there. Mm-hmm. And there's all these yachts moored there along the shore. And there's no facilities to get rid of your wastewater that you collect on the yachts. And at some point, I swear, I was swimming. First, I saw the toilet paper coming by.
No.
And a half a minute later, I saw what had been wiped floating past.
Well, so, welcome to paradise, Arjan.
I know that the tourism agency on Bonaire is going to kill me for saying this. But it happens. And that's just because there's no facility for the yachts to dump their wastewater. Which is why, together with STINAPA and the public entity and the Ministry of ENW, we are now looking at, can we not make holding tanks at the marinas and make a policy that requires yachts to dump their wastewater there and then get it processed in the wastewater treatment facility. So those are the kind of things we support on the islands.
Yeah.
And at the same time, we try and bring the urgency for instance, sewage treatment facilities to the politics in The Hague, informing the minister, look, this is happening right now. There's no sewage treatment on the islands. How can you allow that to happen? It is it's legally required in the Netherlands, the European part of the Netherlands.
Why not there?
Have three municipalities on the other side of the ocean where there's nothing.
Yeah.
Well, on Bonaire, there's sewage treatment.
Yeah.
And that's pretty state of the art. It just needs some expansion. But, you know, that's the kind of things that we work on.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of politics, by the way, I just saw an article pass by with the title D66 in Action for Nature Caribbean Netherlands. It was just published right now, and it could have been a response to the meeting they had in the parliament, I think, yesterday.
Oh, Natuur. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, a response to that. So the article reads that the
10-puntenplan.
Yeah, the 10-puntenplan. Yeah, the 10-point plan. Tjeerd de Groot. Tjeerd de Groot from the party D66 has presented his 10-point plan with concrete suggestions on what needs to happen.
Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah, you saw that. Okay, good.
Yeah, he presented that during the general meeting about nature last Monday.
Yeah.
And for the first time in ever, I think, there's one of the 10 points is the Caribbean Netherlands and the mm-hmm. coral reefs. So that's pretty unique, I think, for a political party in the Netherlands to have the Caribbean Netherlands so high up in the agenda.
Yeah.
It's a pleasure to see.
Yeah.
And
definitely very significant.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and we had some chats with Tjeerd.
Nice, but that's super super cool to see. Also, I guess for you as well to see that the work that you're doing, you know, the amount of lobbying, because I also know, you know, you mentioned it as well. You visit the islands, pre-Corona times. You visited the islands for several months a year, two times a year, I think you would go for several months.
Yeah, three times a year
on
average.
Yeah, and then you have the local representation as well, really trying to change what's going on there and to change the destruction that is still taking place when it comes to the environment, but then also addressing it more holistically. So not just saving species, but really going to the root of the cause as well, and to see that all those efforts are having effect and that they are kind of reaching the consciousness and the voices now of politicians in the Netherlands, that must be very pleasing to see as well.
It is, and it's not only in The Hague. I mean, mind you, this process started in 2016 when the King organized a symposium asking for attention for the coral reefs in the Dutch Caribbean. That's like 4 years ago. And now, 4 years later, yeah, you were. so you have seen the presentations and you've seen the urgency and you've seen the big shots that were there.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes 4 years to come to the stage where you have a plan, you know?
Yeah.
So that's something you have to take into account. It's almost impossible to do it faster and unless you ram a provincial house with your how do you call that tractor
just run it over, bulldoze it, right?
You've just inspired me.
but as I was saying, it's not just political The Hague, it's also the islands themselves.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you look at the discussions on Bonaire about the master plan Bonaire, half the people say we need to change. We need to do it differently.
Yeah.
So there is a movement ongoing that I think has huge potential to change the way things work and actually put the nature at the center of your economy.
Absolutely.
It just requires action, you know?
Yeah. It requires action, and maybe also to refer to our previous podcast. It requires this approach where you also address the human side of the issues, right? So it's not just about, you need to think about these issues in a very broad spectrum. So last time we talked about, you know, this concept of intersectional environmentalism, that all the environmental but also the societal issues that we face or that and also that are taking place on the islands, you know, when it comes to poverty, because that's also a very big issue there, these issues are something you can address jointly, and they affect each other as well. You know, if people are constantly worrying about whether or not there will be food on the table, they will not have the mind space to think about saving the environment or getting rid of their waste properly. But if you have facilities, I'm just saying random things out loud here, but if you would have a facility where they could bring their waste, get some money for it, for example, and then are able to buy food with that, you know, you're already kind of stimulating that behavior in a completely different direction and solving many problems that they have at once. I mean, this is a very simplistic example, but just to make a point here.
Yeah, no, and I agree. That is exactly what I'd like to help with,
mm-hmm.
to build those bridges that are currently, how do you say that? These communities are too distant from each other to actually. Mm. And I understand that because I didn't study economy. Mm-hmm. I don't know how what's on the issue or on the mind of, in the private sector. I don't know what the issue is with fishermen that don't catch enough fish to make ends meet, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that the people who make the legislation or the nature conservation people should definitely take into account when developing new legislation, making new rules, that, you know,
mm-hmm.
include these people in the discussion.
Yeah.
And do you think it's not happening enough right now?
I think that it's changing, but it's definitely not happening enough. No.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah.
So there's lots of work to do.
That depends, actually. Because it depends who does it. I mean, I remember, actually, Tim, didn't you, as part of the Iguana Project on Stacia, have a big awareness campaign around it? And whatchamacallit, involvement of people trying to get them to change the way they fence their garden, stuff like that.
Yeah, that was something we were working on about 5 years ago, I think.
Yeah, exactly. But that's how it should be, you know. You engage with the people that, well, I don't want to say cause the problem, because it's not a choice, so to speak.
Yeah.
Oh.
But if you don't know that your fence kills iguanas, then you're not triggered to fix it, mm-hmm. you know? So engaging yeah. with the community to say, look, this is a problem and this is why it's important and this is what you can do and this is how we can help and, you know, and how does it affect you? What do you need out of it? You know, all this consultation and these discussions about really understanding what drives others.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's essential.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely
true. And that's why you need to be there.
That's why you need to be there. No, but I think what you said is true. I mean, it helps so much if you're on island yeah. and I don't know. I personally, and I think Tim as well, it's just very nice to hear the shifts that are taking place and yeah, that it's taking a lot of time, that it takes a lot of time, I should say. That's yeah. a given, right? So it's not an easy thing to solve. These problems that we're facing, they are so large and they are so complex and they are so weaved in our ways of doing and thinking and on a global level and then also on a local level. So how do you shift mentalities, perceptions and behaviors all at once? That's never going to happen. The only thing that you can do is take it, you know, step by step, day by day, and lobby from all kinds of directions, from bottom up to top down.
Right.
And then slowly but surely, I think we will see the changes that are required.
Yeah, I think you're right. And exactly. that's the process, how it should be going. The only problem I have with that is in 10 years, there's not going to be much coral reef left if we don't significantly change yeah. the way we work.
I was just about to say, because a lot of these changes, yes, they take a lot of time, but for a lot of aspects, we don't have enough time. Yeah. And it's extremely frustrating on more occasions than yeah. one. I can yeah. guarantee you that. I think that's something that you probably see as well, Arjan.
It is, of course. And if you have a pretty clear idea after talking to everybody, after getting the science behind it and figuring everything out, you know what needs to happen. And then you present this to whoever needs to be doing it. And it just, nope. Doesn't happen. Or yes, good idea. Yep. Let me know if you have $2 million and then we'll make it happen, you know. Then you're kind of biting your knuckles a little bit.
Yeah.
But that doesn't, it shouldn't stop you from doing what you do, because sometimes things do change mm-hmm. and unexpectedly quickly.
Yeah.
To name an example, that was something that Stacy was involved in, the setting up of Piscabon, mm-hmm. the fishing co-op on Bonaire. We didn't expect that to be successful. We basically thought, hey, we need the fishermen to be a united front so that we can talk to all the fishermen and their representatives. Mm-hmm. So let's see what happens if we try to set up a fishing co-op. And it worked, you know?
Yeah.
Within 2 months. So, you know, keep going, because stuff happens.
Yeah. I was just about to ask if this would be the first podcast where we need to conclude that we actually are doomed, but I'm happy with this with this final statement of you, Arjan, that there's still hope and that we just need to keep pushing and keep going and be hopeful, like you said, that sometimes changes can, you know, occur in unexpected moments, in unexpected ways. And I think we are, and that's maybe my optimistic little voice in my head, that we are somewhat reaching a tipping point, and that I think the changes that we are going to experience and the change in behavior, or the changes in behavior, are going to accelerate. So they are going to grow exponentially in a positive direction. I'm very hopeful that that will be the case, because I also think that that will be the only way that we can actually save humanity on this planet.
Yeah, I think there's more and more people realizing that we need to change if we don't want to destroy our planet.
Yeah.
And it's gaining mass, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
It's getting bigger and it's getting close to a point that there's going to be, well, you had the climate demonstrations a while back from all those kids.
Mm-hmm.
Things are moving. People yeah. are becoming aware. So I think you're right. I hope you're right.
Me too.
I was just saying, like, especially now with Corona, I said it, Corona, people are more aware about the, you know, the problems that can arise from deforestation or destruction of natural areas and how important it is to, you know, preserve these places. So I also definitely agree that people are getting more aware on the situation and thus we're not doomed yet.
Awesome.
Right, Stacey?
Right, Tim. There you go.
And Ariel.
Exactly.
Well, I think this is a perfect way to end this awesome podcast. We've been chatting for a while now, and I really enjoyed this conversation. I hope you guys did too.
I did. Cool. It was a pleasure.
Yeah. I hope the listeners have learned something about NGOs and WWF and, you know, all the great work that you guys are doing on the Caribbean. And yeah, let's keep each other posted.
We will, I'm sure.
Awesome.
Thanks for everything, Ariel. It's great having you on.
No problem. Pleasure.
We hope you enjoyed and learned something from this episode. We've provided links to the articles mentioned in the description for further reading. And don't forget to subscribe, and until next time on We're Not Doomed.